from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Of all the issues in this year's bruising presidential election, perhaps none separates the candidates as clearly as the environment. From core philosophy to policies that touch the deepest American wilderness, George Bush and John Kerry stand miles apart. Tonight, in our series of hours looking at key campaign issues, we look at the candidates' plans for the air, land, and water. In the October 8th debate in St. Louis, President Bush said that he's got a solid record on the environment.
I guess you'd say I'm a good steward of the land. The quality of the air is cleaner since I've been the president. Fewer water complaints since I've been the president. More land being restored since I've been the president.
Senator John Kerry countered that he would be a true environmental president and that Bush's environmental record has been one of the worst in modern history.
Boy, to listen to that, the president, I don't think, is living in a world of reality with respect to the environment. Now, if you're a Red Sox fan, that's okay, but if you're a president, it's not.
The Red Sox might beg to differ this year, but the issue plays for Kerry. 60% of adults in an October Gallup poll said Kerry would better handle the environment, against 31% for George Bush. Kerry has a two-decade Senate record of voting for tough regulation. During his presidency, George Bush has focused on building partnerships with industry, on voluntary compliance, on offering incentives to control pollution. Tonight on Point, the candidates and their plans for the environment. How important is the environment to your vote this year? One environmental group gave John Kerry effectively an A rating and Bush an F. Is that the end of the story? Is it possible that Bush has an approach that environmentalists just don't understand? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin with a hard look at the two candidates' plans for the environment. Jane Kay is environment writer for the San Francisco Chronicle and joins us now. Jane, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
So give us the top view here. Everybody says there's nothing that separates these two men like their record and their view on the environment. How does that look to you?
Well, their opinions are very, very sharply divided. On one hand, you have President Bush, who really supports voluntary measures. He likes to work with property owners, say, in protecting endangered species. He's even proposed letting power plants expand and do repairs without putting on the new controls that would right now be required under the Clean Air Act. He wants to give incentives. He wants to work through the market. And on the other hand, you have Senator Kerry, who also wants to give incentives and work through the market. But he does believe in regulation. He thinks, for instance, that the Clean Air Act would cut many more pollutants by requiring the companies to put on the controls. For endangered species, he wants to see more animals listed. He wants to see more money given to make the law work.
Jane, let me ask you, if I may. The League of Conservation Voters, as you've reported and many others have, give George Bush an F, the only F they've ever given to an American president for his environmental policy. But we just heard this tape of George Bush saying the air is cleaner, fewer water complaints, more land restored. Why is the president getting an F rating from this leading environmental group when he's making these kind of claims for progress? What's wrong with this picture?
Well, because the president is a candidate and he's making claims. We have had a recent EPA Inspector General's report saying that some of his changes to the Clean Air Act have already seriously hampered enforcement efforts against the coal-fired power plants and potentially blocking, I think it was cuts of 2.3 million tons of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides. So every one of these issues, you have to look at the facts. He has been very aggressive in promoting his forest initiative, you know, which he says will reduce catastrophic forest fires. But yet there are many scientists who say that he has opened up, you know, millions of acres of what are now wilderness to roads and logging. So you have an argument on each side.
So what has happened under the Bush administration that might be changed under a Kerry administration? What kind of turn of the steering wheel on environmental policy might voters expect?
Well, of course, it has a lot to do with the support Kerry will get in Congress. But one of the things the Bush administration has done, it doesn't support what is known as the polluter pays principle under Superfund, the program to clean up the nation's worst toxic waste dumps. The Bush administration does support the companies cleaning up their own mess, but there are many other sites that are called orphan sites. And up until the fund ran out of money, you know, the chemical and oil industries had been charged a fee, and that fee went into a fund for those cleanups. Well, Senator Kerry supports this polluter pay principle, and he wants to reinstitute that tax on oil and chemical producers. He wants to be a lot more aggressive on having the U.S. join the Kyoto Protocol, which is the international treaty that would require reductions in carbon dioxide, which is the greatest greenhouse gas.
Though Kerry's saying he wouldn't sign on to that until China signs on to it, if I've got that right.
Well, the way, at least what his campaign people say, he says he would join the international community and work out a negotiation. I don't believe that he has made that one, you know, set forth that one criterion. But the Bush administration, on the other hand, has so far been opposed to any kind of mandatory cuts in carbon dioxide emissions, and that's a pretty great difference. There are very profound differences on energy policy as well.
Lay those out for us. That seems fundamental to any environmental program.
Yes. You know, one of the president's biggest programs has been his energy bill, and it was offered soon after he came into office, and it would provide tax breaks and regulatory relief for mainly the coal and oil industries, and give subsidies for nuclear power and ethanol. There are provisions for renewables, but not on the scale that it would be for coal.
So big emphasis on
oil.
Fossil fuels under George Bush's plans.
Yes, that's correct. And he, on the other hand, Kerry has been one of the politicians in Congress who has actively fought the energy bill, and he wants a federal mandate on utilities to produce 20% of their electricity from renewables such as solar, wind, geothermal by 2020.
And he's willing to put government money up in the tens of billions, if I've got that right, Jane.
Yeah, well, his $10 billion was for a clean coal technology, so he is turning an eye, I think, to the states where coal is important. And President Bush had already committed, at least he'd asked for in the budgets, I think, almost $2 billion for clean coal.
Jane, one thing that really has caught environmentalists' eye under the Bush administration is the appointment of lobbyists and kind of industry people to very high positions of environmental oversight. Can you give us some of that record, if you would?
Yes, and that goes back to your question before about why do some of these environmental groups oppose President Bush? And this is a pretty widespread criticism. You know, they say that he's too willing to relieve business of regulatory responsibility, and he has placed in very high positions in the White House, in Interior, in the EPA, people who once represented polluting businesses and extractive industries, and they have long famous records of fighting environmental regulation. And I think it was Carl Pope, who's executive director of the Sierra Club, mm-hmm. who said that there wasn't, that after Christy Todd Whitman left the EPA, that there wasn't really one highly placed official sympathetic to the environment within the Bush administration.
So they feel like they've got lobbyists and industry people, but not real environmentalists there.
That's the way they feel.
Now, the Bush philosophy has been what? He's always saying, let's work with industry. We don't need to make this confrontational and regulatory. We can work with industry, use market forces to do better. Has that been borne out?
Well, yes, he has proposed this. In his Clear Skies initiative, he has sought reductions in nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxide, and really the first first reductions of mercury. He is saying, look, industry, you can use a cap and trade provision. You know, if you reduce your pollution, you know, you can trade this ability to pollute to somebody else.
In other words, create a market in
yes.
Polluting so that if you do better, you've got something to sell to someone who can't do better.
Exactly.
Is that in place now? Is that
well,
functioning?
Well, no, it has been. It's a proposal under the Clear Skies legislation. It hasn't passed. The environmental groups, and I must say Senator Kerry as well, opposed that, saying that it's just too weak, and it wouldn't cut enough, and it doesn't include cutting carbon dioxide, which is of course a big issue in energy.
President Bush promised in the last campaign that he would go for a carbon dioxide cut, and he turned around on that promise.
Well, yes, he did. And one of the reasons that Senator Kerry and most of the environmental groups oppose the cap and trade for mercury because they're saying it would cause hot spots of mercury in around the plants where it's allowed, which mm-hmm. and this would allow the continued flow, you know, of a pollutant that is known to contaminate fish.
So they're saying let's regulate instead. We just don't want this anywhere. We don't want it swapped around.
Yeah, we don't want it swapped around. And while the Bush administration is saying over time you would have a lessening of the amount of mercury, and by 2018 you would have to have these severe cuts, the environmental groups and carriers saying that wouldn't be good enough.
Not good enough. Jane Kay, stand by. We're joined by On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty with me in the studio tonight. Jack, good to have you. Here we have these candidates with very, very different sort of opening positions on the environment. Never mind where you end up, which may be quite different as well, but just very different philosophies about how to approach it.
They do. And, you know, as Jane was talking about Mr. Bush, I was just reminded of a study of delegates to the 2000 Republican convention. And it found the GOP delegates, that is Republicans whom you would think would be the strongest in ideologically committed to Republican ideas, were by 80%. In favor of strict environmental regulation, and by nearly that much, would accept environmental regulation even if it meant slower economic growth and loss of jobs. In other words, Republicans are strongly pro-environment.
But that's not
even
the path this president's
even,
going
to... Even Republican delegates to the convention. And yet the president in office, that's not what he's done. And if you look at the, you know, don't have to be a cynic to just note that he has received from energy and extractive industries, that is the GOP has since
extractive as in mining.
As in mining, $118 million since 2000.
And yet George Bush is saying this regulatory way is not the way to go. We've got to find a better way. Environmentalists say forget about it. We're talking tonight about Bush and Kerry on the environment. John Kerry has an A rating from environmental groups. Bush has an F. Is that all we need to know? Is it possible that Bush just has a different approach Or does he deserve that failing grade? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Bush and Kerry records and plans on the environment. You can join our conversation tonight. Can industry be trusted to regulate itself in the Bush style, or does industry need tough Kerry-style oversight on pollution controls? How do you see the Bush record on the environment? What would you expect from President Kerry if that should come to pass? Tonight we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in the studio by our own Jack Beatty from San Francisco, by Jane Kay, environment writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, and now by a couple of representatives of the Bush and Kerry camps. Joining me tonight from Sebasco Estate, Maine, is Lynn Scarlett. She is Assistant Secretary of Policy, Management, and Budget at the Department of the Interior. She served on President Bush's Environmental Policy Task Force during his 2000 presidential campaign. Lynn Scarlett, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Glad to be with you.
And with us from Washington, L.G. Holstein, Senior Advisor on Energy and the Environment for the Kerry Campaign, former Associate Director for Natural Resources, Energy and Science at the Office of Management and Budget, former Chief of Staff for Energy Secretary Bill Richardson, for Transportation Secretary Federico Pena. L.G. Holstein, thanks so much for joining us.
Tom, thank you for inviting me. Nice to be with you.
Lynn Scarlett, let us go to you first. We're looking at these environmental groups' rankings or ratings. President Bush gets an F. John Kerry gets a 96%, looks like an A to us. How do you explain that? If President Bush is doing such a good job, why is he getting such a low ranking from the League of Conservation Voters?
Well, I think partly it depends on what you look at. If we go beyond the adversarial headlines and look at the achievements on the ground, there are some significant ones. But you're quite right to point out that the president has called for a new environmentalism, a different emphasis, an emphasis on partnerships, on cooperative conservation, on innovation and incentives. And let's spend a moment looking at that record. At Interior, for example, we have increased by 270% our investment in cooperative conservation grants since 2000. And just in the past 3 years, that tallies up to a $1.3 billion investment.
What is a cooperative conservation grant, Lynn, if I may ask? What is that?
Yeah, that's an umbrella term that we're using for partnering with landowners, with nonprofit organizations, working in cooperation to achieve on-the-ground results such as wetlands restoration, river and stream bank restoration, and so forth. We have a number of such grant programs. Some of them we inherited, and we have simply increased the dollar amounts for them. And the president created three new programs, two of them, a landowner incentive program and a private stewardship grant program, designed to entice and invite people and inspire them to participate in endangered species protection.
And why is this better than straight-ahead old regulations saying, hey, you can't do that because that's a wetland, or you can't destroy that animal's habitat?
Well, let me clarify, first of all, that the administration does not see this as either or. The administration has kept in place the edifice or the foundation of our major environmental statutes that have built up over the last 30 years and, in fact, put in place new rules, a first rule ever for non-road diesel engines or vehicles that will result in a 90% reduction. And also, they have sped up the cleanup of brownfields, that is, hazardous waste sites that are in urban centers, utilizing some of the regulatory tools that are available.
But still, there is a shift here that Bush is pushing. He's very plain about that. Why?
That's exactly right. The idea is that, you know, ultimately we want to build a nation of citizen stewards. And the way you do that is to bring people into the fold, to partner with them, to knock on the door of a farmer and say, wouldn't you like to work with us and put some stream bank fencing up so that we can improve these riparian areas? You know, ultimately, the reach of regulations cannot spread everywhere across the nation into every backyard and every home. And by contrast, cooperative conservation can. And let me give you a...
But when you partner with mining companies and coal-fired power plants, isn't that like putting the... If you're getting to voluntary cooperative stuff, isn't that the fox in the hen house here? I mean, they have huge profit incentives not to go too far down these environmental paths, don't they?
Well, let me broaden the question, because of course the partners that we're working with run the gamut from ranchers, nonprofit organizations, as well as companies, depending upon the issue and the place.
And some very big ones, some of the most rich and powerful ones in the nation.
We have a number of companies that we've worked with on wetlands restoration, for example. I was just up in Detroit, where we have a very interesting wildlife refuge that is a composite of federal lands and also partners with a local utility up there and some nonprofit organizations. And they are restoring wetlands, restoring marshlands, and creating a 32-mile greenway along that river. That's the kind of partnership that we're investing in. But let me go back to your question of why this emphasis. And let me give you an example.
Why isn't it the fox in the hen house? Why should we trust industry to police itself on this when it has a profit incentive, in many cases, to do otherwise?
Well, you're confusing apples and oranges. Again.
Really?
Absolutely. Let's go back to my first statement. We are keeping in place that regulatory edifice. Those rules are there. We are holding people accountable for those standards. What is at issue here is going beyond those regulations to more proactive and prospective protection. How do you do that? How do you get beyond just the regulatory bar? And cooperative conservation is the name of the game there, we think.
Let me bring L.G. Holstein in. I've been waiting patiently. L.G., you've been listening to this. I'd love to get your take on the Bush philosophy and approach to the environment versus the Kerry. Lynn says, look, we've got the basic regulations still in place here, and we're simply reaching out to add to them with something new, this cooperative angle. How do you assess the success of that? How do you assess the likely success in the future?
Well, I think we have some real problems with it. I certainly agree with Lynn's statement of a couple of minutes ago in which she said that these two approaches need not be an either-or proposition. And indeed, Senator Kerry absolutely embraces the idea of working cooperatively, for example, with landowners under the Endangered Species Act, so that you work out an agreement. It's called a habitat conservation agreement, and you promise that landowner that landowner won't be prosecuted provided the land is used in a way that meets the agreement. In other words, both parties come to the table, you work it out cooperatively, you protect the species as well as the rights of the landowners. These cooperative approaches do work when they're put to use. The only problem is the other side of the equation, and that's where I think this administration has let us down. They are charged with being stewards of the public lands as well as of our air and water, and I think that they have been too ready to abandon some of these long-standing, very important core environmental statutes that protect our clean air and our water. The president, for example, in his very first months in office, proposed allowing the amount of arsenic in our water to increase. The public outcry was so great he had to beat a hasty retreat. In general, I think there's a great deal of concern in the scientific community about the administration, in some cases turning its back on science, and in other cases actually distorting the science.
So what would John Kerry do differently, Elder
Well,
Holstein?
I think we need to listen to the scientists, and global warming is one of those kinds of concerns.
Mm-hmm.
People who, I think, have begun to pay attention to the impact that weather, such as the hurricanes, can have on our economy and jobs, not to mention lives and communities, understand that we have to pay attention to the scientists when they tell us, as they are in overwhelming numbers, that human activities, and particularly the burning of fossil fuels, are having a discernible impact on the climate.
So what should we pay attention to in the Kerry plan?
There are particular elements of the Kerry plan that I think are important, and they combine the cooperative approaches of the habitat conservation plans I described a minute ago with an enforcement arm. In other words, instead of, as the Bush administration has done, letting the utility industry off the hook through a loophole that they created in the Clean Air Act, we believe there should be enforcement actions under the Clean Air Act so that when the utilities make upgrades to their power plants, they have to meet the new source review requirements. That means the Clean Air Act requirements to make the air cleaner. In short, we think polluters should pay. The president absolutely opposes putting the Superfund tax back in place that taxes the polluters to clean up the messes that have been made in the years past.
John Kerry would do that.
And John Kerry would reinstate that tax. Right now, the taxpayers are picking up that tab, not the companies that left the mess behind.
If I may, Jane Kay at the San Francisco Chronicle, you're listening to these two representatives of the Bush and Kerry camps, both making the case that their men are environmentalists. And yet I'm still looking at this League of Conservation Voters ranking, and they've got a pretty long history themselves, pretty attuned. They're tough on all presidents. They gave Bill Clinton a C-. They gave George Bush's father a D+, but they're giving this president an F. Why?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, even the local watershed groups, the enormous national groups, they really don't like the way President Bush has been safeguarding the environment. I was listening to the comments from both sides of the campaigns, very interesting, and I was trying to think of, say, for instance, the Endangered Species Act and how it's working on the ground here in California under this administration. And there have been some good partnerships trying to protect some of the animals with the ranchers and the cattlemen. But on the other hand, for instance, we have a furry mammal up on the north coast, a weasel-like creature called the Pacific fisher. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which has authority for making the Endangered Species Act work, says that it should be listed, but it said it just doesn't have the money to list it, and it's not going to list it. So there are some forest industry groups that are coming forward with plans to take care of the fisher. Well, I think many in the public, at least from the mail that I'm getting, they just don't trust that that will happen, because These forest groups are loggers. It's not in their interest to keep the habitat of the fisher. And I think they want the backbone of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So it's those kinds of issues.
Lynn Scarlett, there's a case in point where people are just concerned about whether industry will really step up and protect a weasel-like creature on the Pacific coast when it may get in the way of their logging. Is George Bush depending on a dependable ally here?
Remember that the listing of a species does not result in its recovery. The central focus that we have had...
What do you mean by that? That it can be written off? What do you mean exactly?
No, I mean that under the Endangered Species Act, when you list a species, that in fact results in the species being listed and then triggers the identification of critical habitat for that species. But it does not translate into actions on the ground to restore habitat, improve habitat, and actually recover the species. Our focus has been to try and change that orientation and say, let us invest in cooperative partnerships, in conservation on the ground, so that we are restoring habitat, so that we don't put ourselves in the position of needing to list species in the future. Mm.
Jane Kay, are Californians reading it that way, Jane?
Well, not only Californians, but a federal judge has recently ruled that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was not carrying out its obligations under the Endangered Species Act by... that said that the Bush administration was minimizing the value of designating critical habitat, and that critical habitat was essential in bringing about the recovery of the species, and that was the goal of the Endangered Species Act.
The goal is to actually recover species, not to list them, nor to specifically just designate habitat. And again, we inherited a situation in which the previous administration experienced a lot of litigation regarding the listing and designation of critical habitat that was eating away enormous portions of the endangered species budget. And we have tried to instead shift that orientation away from the litigation, which doesn't get anything done on the ground, and instead invest in cooperative conservation. And
Lena, I want to turn to our callers for just a second. They've been waiting patiently. We've just got a minute before the break here. If I may, Hans is calling from Oregon, Wisconsin. Hi, Hans. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to offer the view I promote in the world. My perspective is that the person we elect president this November is almost irrelevant to issues like global warming and running out of petroleum.
Now, why is that, Hans?
The reason is we, the people, elect a president. We cast a ballot for a president once every 4 years. We vote at the gas pump 1,458 times in that period. And we're casting our ballot. I mean, we don't need a president to say, to get behind the Kyoto Protocol, for example. If we wanted it, we'd do it.
So every time you fill up, you say you're casting a vote. And yet, don't those policies from the top make a difference?
On presidents,
yeah.
You want to go revisit the late 90s during the Clinton years.
Mm-hmm.
We had Gore in there. He was quite progressive, I thought. Sprawl skyrocketed. SUV ownership skyrocketed. Fuel consumption went up and up and up. How was it better under Democrats? Things actually got a little better in some of those respects under Bush. And it happened because of the economy tanking.
Right. So you're saying Americans, heal thyself with thy own lifestyle choices. Hans, thanks for calling. Jack Beatty, you see what's laid out on the table before us, a kind of very different approach to these things. And then Hans calls and says, you know what, at the end of the day, it's about how we live and the choices we make as individuals. Yet government policy creates a frame for those choices.
It certainly does. And he raises the issue of global warming. And here, from the point of view of the future of our posterity, both of these candidates are dearly wanting. They're talking about survival of you know, animal species. We want that. The issue is the survival of the human species. A study for the British government says by 2050, irreversible climate change will begin unless we restore the levels of carbon dioxide emissions of 1990 and start peeling back. And neither candidate is talking seriously about that. And I hold Kerry responsible more. Obviously, he wants to carry coal country and West Virginia and so on. But he has failed in his obligation, it seems to me, to educate the voters about what is at stake here and about what we owe the future. Bush is clueless about it. He could care less. Kerry knows these things, as Al Gore before him did, and Al Gore failed too.
LG, 20 seconds, and we'll come back to it. LG.
I have been listening as patiently as I could. This is astounding. There couldn't be a clearer difference between these two candidates on this issue of the environment and specifically on the issue of global warming. President Bush, when he was running for election the first time, said that he was thought that the problem of global warming needed to be addressed with controls on carbon emissions, and as soon as he was in office, he turned his back on those issues and pulled us out of the international negotiations to fight global warming. John Kerry has said repeatedly, and in the Senate, helped lead the effort to get us on board an international agreement to cut our emissions of
LG Holstein, hold the thought. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking about Bush, Kerry, and the environment. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about George Bush and John Kerry on the environment. You can join the conversation tonight. Who speaks to you on the environment and why? And what do you see in the fundamental environmental philosophies of George Bush, of John Kerry? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by Jane Kay from the San Francisco Chronicle, environment writer there, by Lynn Scarlett from the Bush Camp. She's Assistant Secretary of Policy, Management, and Budget at the Department of the Interior, and by L.G. Holstein, a Senior Advisor on Energy and the Environment for the Kerry Campaign. He's been Chief of Staff for Energy Secretary Bill Richardson and for Transportation Secretary Federico Pena in the Clinton administration. Our own Jack Beatty is with us as well. Let's get a call. Melanie is calling from Provincetown, Massachusetts. Hi, Melanie. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the idea that corporations, energy corporations especially, are going to regulate themselves seems like another one of those kind of rose-colored glasses ideas that are always promoted by the Bush administration. It seems to me that there wouldn't be regulations if people were doing the right thing to begin with. I live in Provincetown, Massachusetts, on the very end of Cape Cod.
Yeah.
80% of the land where I live is owned by the National Seashore. And I can tell you, the people in my community often complain about the seashore, but even the most vehement complainers really understand that without the seashore, Provincetown would be developed beyond belief. Regulations actually help to keep people in check. It seems important.
We've got it, Melanie. And Lynn Scarlett, that seems to be thrown to you. Still this question about the fundamental philosophy and whether it ends up being a kind of giveaway. Melanie says if we didn't need regulations, if companies would have acted right in the first place, we wouldn't need regulations and oversight.
You know, let us again go back to square one. I have suggested that the Bush vision is one that builds upon the existing foundation of regulations. There is not a proposal for self-regulation, but rather a looking forward into the 21st century and asking how can we go beyond that? How can we create a nation of stewards? And through our incentive programs in development of alternative fuel vehicles, for example, through our conservation grant programs where we are working with ranchers, working with farmers, working with utility companies in wetlands restoration, in stream bank restoration. We think these are the way to expand conservation and environmental protection across the nation. Again, building upon the existing regulatory foundation. So
LG,
we need to focus on what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. LG Holstein, I want to bring you in again. President Bush always says, on many issues, and here on, again on the environment, I'm trying to change the way we do things so that it will work better in the 21st century. What's your critique of the way that's changing? And I had to cut you off a bit before on where John Kerry ultimately takes the country in terms of the huge challenge Jack Beatty brings up, and I'll put this to Lynn as well, but you've got global warming sitting out there. Is John Kerry, are his programs radical enough to really take that issue on?
John Kerry is, and I'll be very clear about this on your show here, so all your listeners will have this straight. John Kerry is committed to moving forward with an international cooperative agreement that's fair to the United States and protects jobs here, but binds us to a long-term goal of reducing our emissions of climate-changing gases. The Kyoto Protocol may have been overtaken by events now, but that doesn't mean we should turn our backs on the need to do something about global warming. In particular, I think it's important to note that in California, we have Governor Schwarzenegger joining with a bipartisan, in fact, it was unanimous in the California legislature, adopting a bill that will require all new vehicles beginning in January of 2006, I'm sorry, beginning in 2012, to emit almost 25% less CO2, that's the carbon dioxide,
right,
the major global warming gas. And the governor is touting it and swearing that he will defend it in court, and that is the kind of bipartisan approach we used to have in this country. President Bush opposes those kinds of measures. It seems to me that we never would have gotten as far as we have with environmental cleanups, with environmental improvements, if we simply went hat in hand to people and said, won't you just be a conservationist? Won't you be a good citizen? There are millions of Americans and millions of corporations that are good corporate citizens. But there are too many others who are willing to take advantage of lax regulation to pollute our air and our water.
We've got a lot of callers who want to join us, and I want to try and get several in here. David is calling from Oakland, California. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Just to almost finish the sentence of that previous speaker, I would say that it may be that certain corporations are acting responsibly, but at the same time, when you have centralization of corporations, they're buying up each other. All it takes is one idiot at the top of the biggest of the corporations, and you can have 50 good ones, but they're all tiny, but one massive corporation that'll do a lot of damage.
But you hear Lynn Scarlett, she's saying, look, we're keeping basic regulations in place here. It's just at the margins that we're working cooperatively. Do you feel confident, comforted by that, David?
Not at all, because essentially what these people are doing with the budget busters, so to speak, of the environmental budget, they're essentially giving us excuses why self-preservation is not cost-effective, that we can't afford to spend the money to save our lives. So if it's a given that certain global, you know, certain hazardous wastes are being spilled at random, they've been spilled in the past and not been cleaned up, they're tainting the aquifer, the air is becoming more foul, there are dead zones in the ocean. So that said, is there a budget to deal with these? Or are we going to just do finger pointing and then let the planet slowly choke? So essentially that's the issue, whether self-preservation is cost-effective with these people. Now Moses came up with an idea a couple of thousand years ago of Jubilee, where you just cancel the debts and you hunker down and you save the planet.
How does it apply here? What do you mean by that?
Well, we're going to have to go off budget to save our lives, right? If, say, for example, with the global war on terrorism, we're going to go off budget to save our lives, why not do the same thing for the environment? Which is more important, the vanity of who did what with, guns, or what is truly going to need to happen with the global climate change?
David, stick with us. I want to hear Lynn Scarlett respond to your approach there. Lynn Scarlett, what do you say to David?
Look, I think we need to turn the discussion to...
Well, we're going to talk about what David has just raised here, if you don't mind. He's saying we need to step up in a big way to this environmental challenge, even if it's not immediately economically obvious how we do that. The stakes are just that high. I don't want to turn away from that issue, if you don't mind. Can you deal with that, Lynn?
Environmental success ultimately depends upon accountability. And the Bush administration is holding accountable those entities that have created hazardous waste. We have proposed to speed up and, in fact, cut in half the time to clean up abandoned mine lands.
But I thought we've heard tonight that in the Superfund, they've dropped the tax that would ask polluters to clean up those Superfund sites.
Let me continue the thought. It requires accountability, and 70% of Superfund sites are, in fact, sites where there is a responsible party, and the Bush administration is committed to holding those parties responsible.
And what about the other 30%?
The other 30% are what are called orphan sites, as was explained earlier,
right,
with no clearly identifiable party. And there we have invested and sped up the investment in cleaning up those orphan sites, which brings me to the second point.
Mm.
Number one is accountability. And number two, as the caller suggests, there is a need for investment. And again, if we look here on climate change, you know, addressing the climate change issue is more than just having an international plan. It is investing. The Bush administration has invested or proposed to invest $4.1 billion in tax incentives for renewable energy, a 42% increase in climate change research, and 18% reduction working with industries to achieve a reduction in greenhouse gas.
Then why the F rating? I'm still stuck on that. League of Conservation Voters F rating for President Bush. Why?
You know, my own sense of that is that for 30 years we have been so used to having the metric of success being what new regulation has passed, rather than to ask ourselves, what are the results on the ground? And let me give you a comparison.
Lynn, I'm afraid I'm going to have to take it there because I got to get to L.G. Holstein in the last minute we've got before we have to go here. L.G. Holstein, I want to come to you with David's question again from California. Is John Kerry prepared to do whatever it takes to get the environment in shape so that we don't have a kind of a global crisis 50 years from now?
Absolutely prepared to do so.
What does that mean for the economy?
And that is where I disagree with David, the caller. It is not... The radical right, I'm afraid, the anti-environmental movement, would have us all believe that to clean our air and water and to keep it that way, we have to tax ourselves and our jobs and businesses to a fare-thee-well, and that simply isn't the case. Now, in the case of the Superfund tax, we heard a very artful dodge there. The fact of the matter is, bottom line, the taxpayers are paying to clean up the corporate polluters. The polluters are not paying. The president opposes the Superfund tax reimposition, and John Kerry supports imposing the polluter pays principle as we used to have. in previous administrations.
L.G. Holstein, I'm afraid with that we're out of time. This conversation is clearly going to go on, Jack Beatty, but we've got a glimpse into the two philosophies, I think, here tonight. L.G. Holstein with the Kerry camp, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Lynn Scarlett with the Bush camp and Jane Kay in San Francisco, thanks to you both. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a Boston Red Sox fan tries to exorcise the curse of the Bambino. This is On Point. Tonight, the New York Yankees and Boston Red Sox play the seventh and deciding game of an epic American League Championship Series. The winner will advance to play either the Houston Astros or the St. Louis Cardinals. In their series, the Astros lead the Cardinals 3-2, and right now are in Game 6, locked at 4-4 in extra innings. For perennially disappointed Red Sox fans, a victory tonight would be a huge step toward exorcising the dreaded curse of the Bambino. Since the Sox traded Babe Ruth to their Bronx rivals 2 years after their 1918 championship, the Yankees have won 26 World Series. The Red Sox have won zero. Fans have gone to outlandish extremes to break the curse. Many have made offerings in front of Ruth's grave. One burned a Yankees camp at the summit of Mount Everest on the purported advice of a Tibetan holy man. Lifelong Red Sox fan Bobby Quillard is confident that this is the year the curse will be broken. He even wrote and recorded a song, The Curse Is Gone, which has been distributed over the Internet. In this radio diary, Quillard explains why he thinks this will finally be the year for the Red Sox.
The curse is gone. The curse is gone. 1918's dead. The curse is gone.
I hate to admit it, and some people might hate me for saying this, but it's a curse. It has to be. Think about it. 1918. If it wasn't a curse, the Yankees would have won the World Series, say, 15 times, and we would have won it 4 or 5. Or the Yankees would have won it 19 times, and we won it 3 times. I mean, the Florida Marlins have been in baseball for, what, 20 years? Less than 20 years, and they've won it twice. We've been since 1918. I was thinking about it. Nothing has broken the curse. What we've had, everything. Like, we're trying to get Babe Ruth's piano and all this crazy stuff. But we have to confront the curse. And we have to sing about it and almost laugh in its face. And then I think we can break the curse.
The curse is gone. The curse is gone.
I wrote The Curse Is Gone last year, right after the Sox lost. It was funny. I watched the game, and my wife, she's from Washington, D.C., so I don't think she understood the magnitude of the Red Sox game. We were watching the game, and Pedro was on the mound, and there was 5 outs left, and I had on my Red Sox hat and my Red Sox shirt, and I was pacing like every other person for New England. And she's like, sweetie, what are you worried about? You guys are up. You guys are going to win. You have your best pitcher. And I'm like, I looked at her, and I said, you do not understand. This is the Red Sox. So I just think every ridiculous thing that's happened, I mean, what else can happen? What else can happen to the Red Sox? I believe that this is the year.
Bobby Quillard is a lifelong Red Sox fan. He and his wife own a graphic design company in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The curse is gone.